PM. I'm Dr. Bruce Padlock, here at the Naturopathic Medical Board meeting. I want to take a moment to acknowledge our legal counsel, Mr. Larson, and our executive director, Ms. Anthony. And we'll do roll call.
Dr. Sadluck?
Here.
Dr. Popio?
Here.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Rubin? Dr. Rubin?
I'm on an important call.
Dr. Sadluck, it appears we're missing Dr. Rubin. We have quorum.
Okay, let's go ahead and we'll get started then. We'll wait for him to join us. Both move to any conflict of interest. I don't think I've received any, and either has Ms. Anthony, so that's our number two agenda item.
This is Dr. Popio. I will be recusing myself from the Dr. Ortiz case.
Okay. Dr. Popio said he'll be off of the Ortiz case. And let's go ahead and do civility statement. In accordance with the open meeting law, the board has civility policy that prohibits any type of disorderly conduct that disrupts the board from carrying out its business. Those violating this policy will be asked to modify their behavior. And if you cannot modify your behavior, we'll disconnect you from the phone call. Consent agenda.
Dr. Sadluck, I'm sorry. Dr. Rubin, are you on the line now?
Present.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, call 03, Dr. Rubin's joined the call. On the consent agenda now we have Dr. Rubin. What I'd like to do is take 4A all the way through 4T as in Tom. And I'll make the motion, but I'll need a second.
This Dr. Campbell, I'll second that motion for approval.
Okay. Thank you. Then let's do roll on that, Gail.
Roll call, please. Dr. Sadluck?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Present.
Motion carries.
Okay, so that takes us all the way from 4A through 4T as in Tom.
Did we just do that?
And then we're going to get into number 5 on our agenda. Let's go ahead and begin 5A. This is case number 22-220, and this is Dr. Jose Ortiz, and this is his initial interview, and I'll ask our executive director to give us some background.
Dr. Sadluck, members of the board, this is case 22-220. On 5-2-2022, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a complaint from patient AR, alleging respondent failed to provide her with the lab results prior to performing a procedure. AR alleges that, according to AR, she advised respondent post-procedure she was not happy with the results, and a follow-up appointment was scheduled. However, she canceled the follow-up appointment and requested a full refund. Having signed the financial disclosure forms that stated refunds are not made, AR was denied the refund. At that time, she filed a complaint with this agency.
And is the complaint on the phone? Okay, noted there's no complaint on the line.
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah, I'm not sure which case you're speaking of. I don't know the doctor that you're speaking of.
We're speaking in reference to case 22-220, and that's Dr. Ortiz.
Oh, no, sorry, it's not me.
Okay. Dr. Ortiz, are you on the line?
I am.
Okay. Can you give us information? Yes, sir, I can
Yes. Summation regarding the patient in question, AR, came to me. Hang on 1 second. Sorry about that. Let me just grab my notes here. My initial contact with AR was back in July of 2021. In summation, she made and canceled or missed a number of appointments prior to her actually receiving her procedure, which was, I believe, December 21st. With regards to the request, her concern with not receiving lab results are not routinely given to patients unless they request them. She did not request the results. She requested what we do is we do pre-op exam, and I do pre-op labs. When pre-op labs came, they were late in coming. Normally we get them a few days ahead of time. They were late in coming. We did receive them. I did speak with her prior to the procedure regarding her labs. She didn't request a copy of them, so we didn't give them to her. We don't routinely just give lab results to patients unless they ask for them. She had requested a copy of her chart, which she emailed me about coming to pick up on a number of occasions, also failed, and all of that in the packet that I sent over. She also failed, she also failed to come back and retrieve those as well. Regarding her concern concern that she had regarding general anesthesia, right in the consent form, it says that I don't do that routinely. Liposuction is done as a awake procedure. We do offer it as, I do have a CRNA that comes in and does offer that. She actually did not want to do that. She decided she would pass on that. She had opportunity to do that. During the procedure, she was pre-medicated. And during the procedure, she had some concerns with pain. We offered to stop several times. We told her she could come back and have it done under general anesthesia. She refused. She continued to cry out. We did what we could to get her as comfortable as possible, and I got through the procedure to the best of our ability to keep her as comfortable as possible with the oral medications that she was given. I'm not sure if you have any other questions regarding the complaint.
Okay, so I have a couple then.
I'll
have the other board members. So you do have a certified nurse that will come in, nurse anesthetist will come in.
Nurse anesthetist, right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Does she have her own equipment? Did she bring that into your clinic?
No, I have equipment. So they bring what they need. I just have monitoring equipment in my office. And it is not general anesthesia, it's propofol.
Right. So the oropharyngeal airway, the EKG, all that, you have that in your office?
Correct. Correct.
Okay. And that is an option for somebody to have her come in and to utilize that equipment. And you do it under a quick life propofol.
Correct. And I don't, as I said, that gets administered by the CRNA.
Okay. And then they have the procedure, and then basically talk to me a little bit about the when they're having the procedure, say they're not utilizing propofol, say they're just utilizing doing the procedure as is.
So if they're not, then the medication protocols vary. I try to keep them in fact I have since gotten away from using opioids at all, but for in her case, she was given 7.5 milligrams of hydrocodone APAP over 325 one tab that at the time of the procedure, and along with 1 milligram of alprazolam and 8 milligrams of ondansetron for nausea. And that's a pretty common cocktail. I no longer use the hydrocodone. We actually just use Tylenol PM now.
Okay. And then when did the procedure, when reading her intake of it, the procedure, when did it become uncomfortable? Halfway through? At the very beginning?
Probably about halfway through. About halfway through.
Okay. And then you offered to either discontinue, or come back
or continue at their, if they want to, we will continue, and we go as slowly as possible, and we give more local, which is the tumescent solution. But that's what the limitations are. The patient wanted to continue, and we did everything we could to do, to get her through the procedure.
Okay. And then go through with me the post-procedural protocol. So you finish.
So post-procedure, vital signs are taken. The patient, there are a number of 2 to 3 millimeter incisions that are made in order to insert the tumescent solution via a cannula. And when we're done, those incisions are not sutured. They're left open so that there's adequate drainage of the solution. The solution is bacteriostatic, so it's actually advantageous to leave those incisions open. The patient is dressed with sterile dressings. We use the Tegaderm dressings over those incisions. And then they have absorbent pads. They get a compression garment, and then they're sent home. And then when I say sent home, she was picked up by someone.
Okay. Then what's the follow-up procedure from there?
Typically, the follow-up procedure is for my office is 72 hours post-procedure, we see the patient.
And this particular procedure was done for augmentation in one specific area?
So in her case, we removed fat. What we did was what's called the 360. So all of the areas from below the breast line down to the labia in the anterior area, all of the what they call the flanks, the sides, and the posterior, same thing from the axilla down to the buttocks. In her case, she wanted enhancement of her buttocks, and we transferred some of that fat. That fat actually goes into a sterile container. It's treated with a clindamycin wash, and then we remove that, and it's put into a sterile injection gun where we go back in and mold and put the fat into the area in order to form a larger buttocks. Now, when we first had our consultation, the patient said she did not want it to be particularly large. We went over that. We were together on that the day of her consultation, the day of the procedure. During the procedure, because she was in so much pain, it was very difficult to actually get all of the fat in that we needed to, but we were able to get in the amount of fat that we expected to, which is in the notes, and I can look that up if you need to have the exact amount, but we were able to do that. Now, later on, she actually sent me a text message where she stated that she was happy with her results, but she was not happy with the fact that her buttocks wasn't as large as she wanted it to be. And I'll look in that. It's in the text messages. It was probably around.
Yeah, I think I saw it. It was about halfway in.
Yeah, it was late December 21 when she was having some issues with drainage, and I ended up getting COVID.
All right, and then obviously, you have a disclaimer that there's no warranties, no guarantees.
Well, that's right. So not only do I have a disclaimer, there's a portion of the consent form that I will refer you to on page 5 of 6, where I actually have the patients rewrite in their own handwriting the following statement. I understand the practice of medicine is not an exact science, and although good results are expected, there can be no guarantee as to the results. She actually writes that out in her own handwriting and signs in dates. There are other places within the consent form which specifically addresses the issue of fat transfer and the possibility of needing to have a second procedure, the possibility of losing up to 50% of the fat, having it just not absorb, have it resorb or not take. Page, there's a, on page, informed, on the informed consent fat transfer to buttocks, on page 2 of 4, the risk of buttocks augmentation procedure, it reads the main risk is 35% chance of significant absorption of fat within 6 to 8 weeks after the procedure. There is no way of predicting this prior to procedure, therefore one must have adequate donor fat available to allow for secondary grafting. Additional liposuction may be needed to obtain more fat. All fees may be the patient's responsibility and surgery will be considered a new procedure. Aside from absorption, occasional minor touch-up may be necessary to correct minor irregularities or asymmetry.
Okay.
And it goes on. I also want to draw your attention to page 3 of the financial policy, which states right at the top, no refunds will be given for services already provided. Again, signed and dated by the patient.
If you could, real quick, on, I believe that's page 21, cephaloxin.
Yep.
Give that to her basically as a secondary in case she has a problem or infection?
So it's a prophylactic.
Right.
Initially, it's given as a prophylactic.
And that's for them to use or if they need to use it?
No, that's for them to absolutely take. It's not a PRN. It's an actual 500 milligrams, one tab, POBID, number 14.
Post procedure. Right. Okay. And then let's go into, okay, procedure's done, patient leaves. Let's go back into the next day. Was that the day you came down with COVID? You were sick?
No, this was a couple of weeks later.
Okay. And then you
so she had already been seen. She had already been seen by me. Everything was okay. And then she contacted me. She reached out to me. Let me just look at this to be absolutely clear. She reached out to me. She missed a few appointments as one of the issues. She missed one of her follow-up appointments. She says on December 17th, good morning, I'm hurting. I said, it's normal. Did you eat anything? This was right after the procedure. She said, okay, yes. I said, did you take anything for pain? She said, yes, I did. Perfect, I'll check on you later. She claimed she had some nausea. And swelling, everything that she was referring to was normal. She asked if she could come in on Monday. I did tell her she could come in on Monday. Looking at the rest of the notes. And she missed that appointment. And then I rescheduled her for Tuesday. Tuesday is when I got sick. So she didn't make her first follow-up appointment. Which I literally, if you go through the text messages, she literally missed or was late for almost every single appointment she ever set, including coming to pick up a copy of her chart notes, which she never came to get.
Okay. Then you get, unfortunately, you get ill. Hopefully, you're feeling better. Then, when you got ill, your medical assistant pulled out of it.
So let's be, I want to be clear on this. So I wasn't really clear. She wasn't, I referred to her as my, she was an independent contractor that just rented space out of my office. I knew, when the patient first contacted me, you'll see in my notes, she asked me if she should go to the emergency room. And I told her that she should, I texted her that she should go to the emergency room if she felt like she needed to. She decided she didn't want to go to the emergency room. So I offered her the opportunity to see the medical assistant in the office, which I refer to as a medical technician. That was just a misnomer there. She's a medical assistant. because the medical assistant had told me that she had done this once before, or she had done this in the past. So I thought if she wanted to, maybe she could do that. At the time, I was very sick, had 103 fever, and I was just trying to get my patient some attention. But I did first tell her she should go to the emergency room.
Okay. And then the important portion of it is you get ill and then your medical assistant. What do you have a standing order with your medical assistant in terms of?
No, I don't.
Go ahead.
I do not. In fact, I never allow anybody to touch my patients. This was literally an emergency situation where I was sick, a little bit disoriented. She says on December 28th, can I go to the ER to get it drained out? I said, if you feel like you need to, yes. Unfortunately, I got really sick today. I'm home with fever and chills. I said, don't let them cut it open with a big incision. It's not necessary. If you decide to have them call me. Then she said, can I come in after 11? I'm sorry, I totally forgot.
Okay.
I said, I'll get you in at 7 a.m. And that's then later on, she said she was hurting. She said, is there anyone you can recommend? I'm hurting, I'm in pain. That's when I let her know she could see the medical assistant. So she does go and see the medical assistant. And if you see later on, she states that she's feeling better. The only issue that she had, I do want to meet you to discuss my procedure. I love my abdomen and back. However, my bottom has gone away. I do not feel like the fat that was injected remains. I know you mentioned in our consultation that you do not do fake, but I was hoping for some enhancement. I know there isn't anything that could be done now, but I'm not happy with the results of the BBL portion.
Okay. Phone back in for me on that medical assistant. Did the medical assistant do any procedure drainage, any type of incision, any type of therapeutic?
No, she did not make an incision at all. No, it was a needle drain.
Okay. And what kind of needle they are using? The 27, 25?
Honestly, I don't know. I won't lie to the board. I have no idea because I wasn't there and I was ill. I don't know what she used, but I'm assuming it's a large bore needle, not a 27. When I drain my patients, I normally use a 20 gauge or an 18.
Okay. And specifically, where did she drain the excessive fluid off?
It looked like it was the lower abdominal area.
Okay.
And she may have gone into one of the incision sites.
Vacutainer?
Yep. Something like a vacutainer or a needle in a syringe.
Okay, let's the plunger fill up.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that are you normally there to supervise when that's done?
I never allow anyone to do that. I do that myself. This was literally an emergency. Like I said, because I was ill that day and with fever, I don't ever have anybody do that. I do that myself.
Okay. All right,
I don't actively have a medical assistant, nor have I had one. I'm looking for one. I'm close to getting one. And I'm hoping that she's amenable to doing what she needs to become certified through the board, but that's where I'm at. I don't have an assistant. I actually do the procedures and all the follow-ups and all of the care myself.
Okay. If a couple things I'm looking for is, number one, if by some odd chance, and hopefully it doesn't happen, you get ill again, do you have anybody, another doctor, that can see that those patients and cover for you while you're ill?
No, patients need to go to the emergency room, and that's the protocol for all doctors that perform these procedures. I'm not the only solo practitioner that does these. And which is why she asked me, and I said if she felt like she needed to, she should go. And so that's, my patients all know that. If I'm not available, they go directly to the emergency room.
Okay. And your medical staff, I know that you always do these procedures yourself, but for example, your MA,
don't have any training.
Well, the one that you have that's a subcontractor.
Right. So I didn't, she just worked out of the office. She did some post-care stuff, or she did some post-liposuction. So it's pretty common now for these liposuction patients to get some massage-type therapies and some energy-type work. And so I believe that's what she did, and that's what I rented the room to her for. So she didn't work for me or do anything with my patients at all regarding patient care from my office.
But you were okay with her skill set as they would be with an MA?
Honestly, I couldn't answer that because I didn't utilize her for that. I did know that she had experience as an MA. And so she has worked as an MA, and she did have a certificate.
Okay. And was the fluid removal from the complaint, was it done pretty much the way that the protocol should have that done?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to my knowledge, she cleansed the area with alcohol, and she inserted the needle, aspirated with the syringe, discarded, and the patient felt better.
Okay. I'm going to move it down to Dr. Rubin. Can I move it down to you?
Yeah, Dr. Rubin, that's fine. Hi, Dr. Ortiz.
Good afternoon.
Hang on a sec here. So I'm trying to just reframe or take a look at this. Wait, Dr. Sadalek, the complainant is not with us? Or is she just late for the call? I don't know. Sorry.
No.
Yeah. So Dr. Ortiz, I'm confused. This is a person, the medical assistant was a person in your office that rented space from you?
Correct.
As an independent
contractor?
She's
rented a room.
She rented a room to do what?
That's what I was just stating. To do what she said was post liposuction care, which involves some massage things and some kind of energy work.
And so, but she's the medical assistant. So she was working as a licensed massage therapist, but just happened to be an MA.
I don't know what she was working at. Like I said, she asked if she could rent the room to do that. She did post liposuction care, and she asked if she could rent the space.
Why as a licensed physician would you allow a medical assistant that has no supervising physician to do potentially complex medical procedure that she wasn't necessarily trained to do and had no oversight, who was just renting a room who you didn't know of her skill set? And if you
when you're referring to complex medical procedure, what are you referring to?
Well, for
You said I allowed her to do, why would I allow her to do a complex medical procedure? I'm not sure what you're referring to.
A drainage of fluid in an office for somebody who isn't trained to do it. I don't even know if she's licensed to do it under her medical assistantship. And medical assistants need to do their procedures under the auspices of a licensed physician who oversees them, for whom they're the medical. I'm just curious why you allowed that to happen, whether or not you consider it complex.
I don't know that she was doing that. I knew that she had done that in the past. I didn't know that she did that within my office. And to my knowledge, she hadn't done it in my office until this patient.
Yes, but you said the med cat or whatever you said,
mm-hmm.
You said if you need to, you said protocol is to send the people to the emergency room. And then you broke protocol by only saying only if you need to, but I don't know how the patient's supposed to know if she needs to or not. And then you were sick, and so I guess I'm curious why you didn't follow protocol. And then you didn't follow protocol, and then you said the med tech, who you mean is the medical assistant, would do it, but that medical assistant wasn't acting as a medical assistant because she wasn't overseen by a physician, and you sent the patient, the complainant, to get drainage of a post-surgical area by somebody who isn't qualified to do that. So, Isn't that?
I understand what you're saying. So the best answer I could give you is, again, I was under duress. I was very sick. I was trying to assist the patient. When you say you don't know what the patient, if the patient says to you, should I go to the emergency room? I think it was pretty clear that I said to her, if she felt like she needed to go to the emergency room, she should go to the emergency room. I couldn't tell from where I was at if she needed to go to the emergency room. I was home in bed with 103 fever. So I wouldn't know if she needed to go to the emergency room, but I definitely gave her the option to do that. So it wasn't like she wasn't informed that she could go to the emergency room. A patient was asking me this again. I was sick. I couldn't even talk, which is why I was texting. So I said, if you need to go, then you should definitely go. But she decided not to go. And then she asked me if there was anything else she could do. So she knew she had the option to go to the emergency room. I was just trying to help with whatever option I could think of in the moment, being in a sick bed. And so I wasn't trying to send her anywhere in general. I could have, as you stated, I could have just said, just go to the emergency room. That's true.
Well, I thought you said that was protocol. You just said it's protocol for people to go to the emergency room, unless I heard you.
It is protocol. And so, I, like I said, I did tell her she should go. She decides to go, what she should do.
You're the doctor.
I'm not trying to evade the question.
Right, but you're not answering it. So a patient doesn't need permission to go to an emergency room. Emergency rooms just exist for people to go to. And so she always has the option. So what I'm saying is that you're saying, unless I'm hearing you wrong or unless I heard something wrong, you said protocol is to go to the emergency room. So I'm wondering why she didn't go to the emergency room. Why didn't you tell her to? You gave her the option.
I didn't specifically direct her to. I didn't. And again, I was disoriented and I was ill. And if that's what you're saying, I did not specifically tell her to go to the emergency room. I did tell her if she needed to go, she should go.
I know you said that. Saying the same thing over and over. I just wanted to know why you didn't tell her, why you broke protocol. Maybe it's not such a good idea when to try and treat patients or give advice when you're not well yourself. Is what I'm saying.
You're right. And I'm definitely guilty of that. And in hindsight, I've looked back at that and realized I probably shouldn't have even answered the phone or text messages at all. I was just trying to see what I could do for the patient, and I probably should not have done that. That's definitely, I agree with you. You're right.
But
I should never have even tried to do that while I wasn't in a good state of mind.
And I still don't understand unless I'm missing something, why you would refer her to somebody to stick a needle in a post-surgical area who you don't know, you don't know qualifications, you have no idea, you're not supervised. I can't understand how that came about. And I know you were delirious, but this is a person, this is a tenant in your space, a subcontractor who you don't know anything about them, is what you're saying. You don't even know what they're doing. And you said, no, go have her stick a needle in you.
No, so what I said was, I don't know if you heard me say, I had a conversation with her in the past where I know that she had told me that if she ever needed to drain a patient, and I said, no, thank you, I drain my own patients. She said she had done it in the past. And I felt, I was aware that she had done this in the past. So in my mind, I was thinking, if the patient doesn't want to go to the emergency room, when she said, is there anything else I can do, that's pretty much it. But in oversight, listening to what you're saying now, I should have just directly said, absolutely, go to the emergency room. And in fact, I should have never even answered the phone. I should have never answered a text message.
Right.
You
can
go to the emergency room.
Fine, I understand that. But what I'm trying to understand is how you came to the conclusion that it's okay to send her to this particular person.
Just based on the fact that the person had told me that she had done this before.
Right. I make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice.
I'll second that motion, Dr. Rubin.
Okay.
Thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Motion carries.
Motion carries, 12:35. We're going into executive session. Dr. Rubin, be back?
Yes, Dr. Rubin is here.
Give me 1 second, please. Okay, Dr. Salek, would you like me to do roll call?
Yeah, so it's 1:01 p.m. and we're back into general session.
Dr. Salek?
Here.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Yes.
Dr. Rubin?
Present.
Okay, so we're ready. Dr. Ortiz, are you still on the phone?
I am.
Okay. Dr. Rubin, did you want to pick back up where you were?
Yeah, thank you. Hi, Dr. Ortiz.
Getting
back to where we were regarding the not med tech, but the medical assistant, who was an independent contractor, a subcontractor in your office, renting space, correct?
Correct.
And you were not aware of what she was or wasn't doing. She was simply a tech. Renting space and not associated with your practice.
Not associated with my practice.
Okay. And you were or you were not aware of her skill set as a medical assistant and as a phlebotomist?
I was aware that she was a medical assistant and a phlebotomist. As far as her skill set, I can't really attest to that because she didn't work for me.
And just to get back to the question, because that's sort of where we left off, is, and if I recall, you didn't have a full reason, and which is okay if you didn't have a reason, but why you referred the complainant to this medical assistant who didn't work for you for this medical procedure.
Right. So I'm not trying to complicate this or circumvent anything. I wanted to say this in my own words. What took place was that the patient reached out to me at a time when I wasn't well, and I was very, very sick, and I was attempting to try to assist the patient. When she didn't want to go to the emergency room, and she asked me what else she could do, that was the only other thing I could think of. Having had a conversation with the person that was renting room, who said that in the past she had done this if I ever needed her to do it, at which I responded to her, I do my own training, thank you. And this emergent moment in this time, this is what I thought of, and so that is the reason why I offered her to go see this person.
That's exceptionally clear and has been. What's not clear is why is a licensed physician you referred or you delegated a duty to somebody that isn't authorized, who isn't even supervised by you, who isn't even associated with your practice, to do something that they're not licensed to do in a complex situation. And so that's number one. We don't have a reason for that. You just did it. And you were sick and you were not. So, you know.
That was the only reason. I don't have a good reason for that other than that.
Yeah. So my concerns are, just to reiterate them, which we've gone over, is number one, you broke your own protocol and you said, yes, I'm guilty of that, I shouldn't have done it. And you say that the complainant didn't want to go to the emergency room. This is my concern, is that you said it's protocol, you weren't thinking right. I don't think it was a good idea that your phone was on. You don't think it was a good idea in hindsight as well. And many times we're trying to do so much and treat, but you know, taking the time to realize that we have to be well to treat patients and we can't move too quickly and we have to do things the right way. And that takes time and careful. And sometimes we can't do everything. So, and then, for me, I don't
you know, giving a patient, if you said, go to the emergency room if you think you need to, make sure that they don't cut, they don't need to, you know, do that. Like, I mean, I see, clearly see how you were trying to help and assist her. This didn't turn out so well, it looks like, because you're before us today. And so there's multiple lines of concern, and then going to delegating a duty and while breaking protocol to somebody who, I won't reiterate it again, who is maybe or maybe not a medical assistant, not associated with your practice, isn't allowed to do this stuff, maybe or may not have done this in the past, didn't know what needed to be done, you hadn't checked. There's a lot of levels. Dr. Sadalek, I'm done. I appreciate the time letting me talk to Dr. Ortiz.
Can I add something? I recognize Dr. Rubin and the concerns Dr. Rubin set forth. I do want to be clear that, and I appreciate you understanding as a physician yourself, I was trying to help my patient. We're not here today specifically for that, in that the patient, the outcome was fine. The patient was never in danger. I did follow up with the patient afterwards. And she acknowledged that she was relieved by that option. I'm 100% in agreement that it was poor judgment on my part to ever try to even make a medical decision when I was really that ill. I was just trying to help my patient. That's all I wanted to add.
Dr.
Spad,
I'm trying to roll up the roster here. So do you have anything you want to discuss with Dr. Ortiz?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Ortiz. Do something. I just want to set a timeline down on how. So after you did the procedure for this lady, this patient, so how many times did she actually come back to do the follow-up? But did she didn't do it at all? I'm a little bit.
No, she did. She did come. She didn't show up for her follow-up when she was supposed to. She ended up trying to make it the next day. The next day I was ill, so she ended up not actually being physically seen for a week after that.
Okay, so after, so 1 week after that, when you got better,
right.
So you actually did follow up and did you actually,
yes,
in person? I just want to get some clarification on that.
I did see her.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then how was the drainage? How was that size?
Everything was resolved. She was fine. Her concern was that she didn't have, as much fat as she wanted to in the BBL portion of her, of the fat transfer. So that was her concern. She also had some irregularities in her skin, which we told her would take time, but that we could go back in and we could do another procedure if she wanted to. She originally scheduled to do another procedure to have a minor touch-up, and then she decided to not do that. At some point, she decided that she was going to file a complaint with the board. She asked for her money back.
Okay. Now, I noticed that there's a... I received the slide from Gail, so I saw some of the picture that was taken. Now, was those pictures taken after you have seen her, or is that before you have seen her?
Let me take a look at that. I believe that was before. Let me just take a quick one, just a second. I know what you're referring to. I'm just sorry. Give me a second.
I believe it's under your text.
Yeah. I'm just looking for that page. Hang on a second. I'm just pulling it up.
Okay,
so that was No, that was before. And that was me telling her it looked like she needed to be drained. And then I was trying to get her in. Then she said, should I go to the emergency room to get it out of the pain? And I should have said, we can record the emergency room. I tried to, we were ready. But those pictures were before. Those pictures were before she was drained. Those pictures were before she was drained.
Okay, so that was before it's drained. Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't have any other question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Not at this time.
Ms. Tippett?
I don't have any questions.
Dr. Campbell?
Thank you. Dr. Lopez, can you hear me okay? Did you mean Dr. Ortiz? My apologies, Dr. Ortiz.
I can hear you.
You can hear me.
Yes, sir.
And so I saw that you were licensed in 2007 is when you graduated from school?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when you graduated, tell me a little bit about when you went into practice. Did you go into practice for yourself, or did you work for somebody else, or how did that go?
No, I went into practice for myself.
And the current practice that you have now, you own that practice, and how long is it since you have you had this practice since you graduated medical school, or did you open at a certain time?
Since 2007.
And besides like your normal CME stuff that everybody goes through on a yearly basis, after you graduated, did you attend any type of additional licensing or certifications or training, or, you know, things that could be considered residencies, internships, special licensure certifications, et cetera?
In terms of licensures, no, I have no other licensures or specialties. As far as if you're asking about CMA training, are you, do you want to know what my,
Let me clarify, doctor. I'm not asking about CMEs. I'm asking specifically, do you have any other certifications?
Right.
Correct.
No, I do not at this time possess any other certification.
And so at some point you started performing liposuction procedures.
Right.
How long in practice did you start doing liposuction procedures?
2009.
And approximately an estimate. How many of these procedures have you done since 2009 till now?
In 700 to 800.
700 to 800.
Correct.
And prior to and during this time, have you had any specific additional training related to these procedures, or was it related to medical school?
Absolutely, no. I had specific training for liposuction. I don't have the exact number, but I have, I spent a week of training in Belgium when I first started. I came back, I trained here with a couple of plastic surgeons. I have 25 hours with one plastic surgeon. I believe I have another 10 hours with another plastic surgeon. I have preceptive and observed. I have attended a number of master classes. I have also been a teacher of liposuction for one of the liposuction device companies. So I have actually trained other physicians, dermatologists, plastic surgeons, general medicine doctors.
Okay. Now, with regard to when you bring in a patient and the patient comes to you with some desire to get any type of procedure, whether it's surgical, liposuction, et cetera, as mm-hmm. part of that screening, is there any type of a mental health screening, or do you talk about the patient's surgical history, respective if they've had the procedure done before or things like that? Is there anything like that that's included in your initial assessment?
We don't do a psychological assessment. That's not necessarily been protocol. We do discuss with our patients that, we ask what their purpose for doing the procedure is. I don't take patients that are doing the procedure for anyone other than themselves. So we ask, what's your purpose for doing the procedure? Why do you want to do this? Are you doing this for someone, for a husband, for another person in your life? because someone's brushing you. That's the only screening that I do as far as psychological goes. We do ask for if the patient has had any previous surgeries and if they've had any previous plastic surgeries.
Okay. And specifically regarding whichever procedures being spoke about, do you ask if they've seen or been consulted by any other physicians or have had a request to do any type of procedure denied by another physician? Is that part of your assessment?
No, we don't ask them if they were denied by any other physician.
Okay.
We do ask them if they've had any procedures. We don't only ask if they've had any previous procedures. Any surgical procedures and any plastic surgical procedures.
Okay. And I understand you've had the same practice since 2007. Have you been in the same location since 2007?
I have not. I've been in this location since 2013, I believe.
Okay. And in 2013, well, The person that you run into space to, when did they come in?
Earlier this year, I want to say, they weren't here for more than, I believe it was a month and a half. I want to say they rented the space in November and were gone by January, the end of January.
Okay. Prior to that, have you had other tenants?
I have. Mm-hmm. I had a lady who did eyelashes.
And so when this tenant, when you were advertising for, if you were advertising for somebody, were there any prerequisites of, you know, looking for somebody in whatever profession, or was it just, I mean, what type of a person professionally wise were you looking for to rent a space from you?
She was referred to me from one of the patients who was getting treatment with her on her own. So typically post-procedure patients seek out post-procedure care. And there are a number of people doing this all over the place. I've come to find out that a lot of these people have no qualifications. This is something that I've learned, and which is why I DC'd this person from my office. I didn't know what her qualifications were, so I just said, hey, enough. She was a medical assistant, and I just didn't even want to be involved with this. And this was before this complaint ever came up. This person that was in the office was out of my office long before this complaint was made. I just realized this was not a good idea on my part to have this person in the office. They were referred to me by one of the patients who was seeing them for post-care, said she did massages and she was really great, and a couple of other patients said they had seen her. They said it'd be a great idea for me to have her in the office. I thought, okay, she wants to rent the space, and that's what I did.
Okay, so at some point did you meet with this person, like, so you find out that she's amazing with helping people through their issues respective to massages. And so you meet with her, and during that time, what did she tell you about herself when you guys met?
She said that she did post liposuction. She did massages, and she did some other techniques with some rolling wood thing, and that the patients had really good result with it. She told me that she was a medical assistant and had done phlebotomy. If I needed help with that, I said no, thank you. I don't have an assistant in the office. I don't want an assistant in the office at this time. And that was the extent of it. I said, if this is what you want to do and you can do it here, for a nominal fee, you can rent out the space. But I won't be acting as your medical director.
I see. And did she display her business card in your lobby, or was her information put on the door, anything like that?
No, definitely not. She did display her certificate as a medical assistant, though.
And when we talk about a certificate for medical assistance, is it a certificate that you collected a copy of prior to her moving in, or?
Took a picture. No, no, I didn't, but I took a picture of it.
Okay. And are you familiar with the state of Arizona, specifically the Board of Naturopathic Physician Examiners licensing for medical assistance for physicians program?
I am. Yes. I am. And that's why I've been actually speaking to a medical assistant who's wanting to do that, who's willing to do that.
And was this certificate anything to do with that program?
No. Mm-mm. It was just a medical assistant.
And was the school that was listed on the certificate that you took a picture of known to you?
I can't say that it was known to me. It was a certificate. It appeared to be a legitimate certificate.
Okay. And did you do any research into the certificate, or, you know, what the school, what the background of the school is, et cetera? If it's accredited,
I did not.
That kind
of... okay. No, I did not. And the reason I didn't do that again is because she was acting independently and she wasn't working for me. But, and I understand what you're asking, but I'm just giving you an idea in my mindset why I didn't bother to do that.
So let's just hypothetical here. I present to you in your office for liposuction, and we talk about the pain management end of it. And at some point I ask you questions about what other things that I can do, non-medical, that could help with my pain or help me progress through the healing process. Is massage something that we're going to talk about? And then if so, during that conversation,
yes,
after this lady moved in, would you let them know, just so you know, we have somebody in the office here that does do that?
Yes, you can talk to them. Absolutely. We just let them know that there's somebody here if you wanted to talk to them. If and when she was here, she wasn't always here, so that was one of the issues as well. She just wasn't always here. But we let them know that there was somebody that they could see in the office if they wanted to. They just, once they caught up with her. But I let them know I had nothing to do with that person, whatever the situation they did.
And the specific area that she rented was, if you have a hallway, you've got exam rooms on one or both sides, and you curl down the hallway when you bring patients in, as an example only. At some point, did one of the doors open to her space, to her office, within
mm-hmm.
that yep. access area?
Okay. Correct.
All right. And then also, respective to this person, when you talked to her, did she tell you how long that she had been doing whatever it is that she was doing? In other words, did she have been in the profession X amount of years or anything like that, or was she new, that kind of thing?
No, she wasn't new. She did tell me that she'd been doing it for quite a while.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chairman, that's all the questions I have for right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Kind of going quickly, Dr. Richards, let me just capture a couple quick thoughts. If someone comes in, let's say morbidly obese, whatever, you simply say you're most likely not going to be a candidate for liposuction?
No, it depends on their general health. It's a case-by-case basis. It depends on their general health. I'm a naturopathic physician, so I do let every patient know initially the first things out of my mouth is that I'm not a plastic surgeon. I repeat it, whether it's in English or Spanish. I let them know that what we do here is a comprehensive program. So we do that, but we are also here for lifestyle, weight loss, and the whole comprehensive program. It's separate from the procedure, but we offer that as part of the plan as well. We talk a lot about lifestyle, weight loss, diet, better health, all of that. That's part of the deal. That's not something we force on the patients. We just let them know that that is something that we offer and that is expected. So we do actually, we do that. We take measurements and weight and all that stuff for our patients. Patients who are larger are often, we often discuss that they may need more than one procedure and they may not be a good candidate depending on how obese they are.
Okay, so let's say someone's a BMI of 50 or 60. Most likely you're going to try your dietary type approach, metabolic syndrome, et cetera, before you're going to get some weight off before you get to it.
That's right. That's right. At 100%. If a patient comes in and they're morbidly obese, we do that. We also, unfortunately, a lot of our patients haven't seen a physician or haven't seen a physician in many, many years. We try to get previous medical history if we can. And that is not typical protocol for liposuction procedures in general. You should know that. I do that because I am a general medicine practitioner. And that is, in fact, what differentiates me from what other doctors do, is that we actually take care of our patient's health, which is in large part of why I'm here, because I should never have answered that phone call that day. But we take care of our patients. We don't just do liposuction procedures.
Okay. And you work above the waist, like, for example, gynecomastia, those types of things, or do you work pretty much below the waist?
Yes. Nope. I do everything. We do neck, arms, thighs. We do every area. The only thing I don't do is calves, and I don't do that. In fact, we recommend when I teach, no one should do that. I know some doctors do that, but I don't do calves. We do everything from the knee up to the neck.
Okay. So, board members, a couple of issues. Dr. Rubin, you pointed some out earlier, and where we're getting kind of stuck is the unfortunate incident, what happened mostly post-procedural when you got done with the services. The procedural, it sounds like you pretty much explained it, and she pretty much wrote in her own handwriting, she understood what you were explaining. Where we run into the problem, and then I'm going to have my board members help us out too, is where the situation becomes the post-care, which unfortunately, in many aspects, you got ill. What I'd like to suggest and what I'd like to see is that any type of post-procedural, whether it's someone who knows liposuction or doesn't, if it's another physician, friend of yours, someone who can you simply call to take call for you. They may or may not be able to help it, but at least there's some type of triage mechanism. The office type issue got really kind of out of condition, and that's going to have to be fixed. So there's a couple of items that were pointed out in our investigative report that we can look at. And one of them is the violation 3215-01DB, if he is a boy, B is a boy. And that's failure to provide proper, personnel procedures in post-procedure care. It sounds as though in this situation you weren't avoiding it. It sounds as though situations, unfortunately, you were ill, you didn't have anyone in place, and you had a provider in there that you were kind of uncertain, and she was uncertain of what her exact role is. So with that being said, I'm going to ask the board members to come up with some type of consent agreement of some sort so we can move this case and get this behind you and get this behind the board today.
Okay.
Do board members have any thoughts, suggestions that they'd like to go with?
Yeah, this is Dr. Rubin. I have concerns. I have concerns about the judgment in multiple levels. One, in breaking protocol, and not having in the delegation issues. It's not. it's just so, for me, as a practicing licensed physician since 1997 or whatever, it's just not okay to delegate some kind of duty like that, which could have other repercussions to break protocol and then send it to some, in this case, near random individual that, to me, this deserves some type of disciplinary action. And I don't know exactly how to formulate it. Somebody else has concerns, but I don't know what else is lurking, and there's no way for me to know. I'm not going to assume that there is anything. All I have is what's in front of me, and what's been in the past. But I have concerns about that and the ability to recognize how to manage and whether or not. Well, anyhow, I don't want to get too verbose. That's where I sit with things.
Okay. Dr. Spack, any thoughts on, I'm trying to get to a consensus agreement today rather than to bring Dr. Ortiz back again. I'd like to get this resolved today. Any thoughts on a consensus agreement?
I agree with what Dr. Rubin have just stated, and I still try to think what consent agreement that we could come up with Dr. Ortiz at the moment. If you could ask the other board members what other suggestions they might, other ideas they might have, and then you can come back to me then. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Tippett.
I don't really have any ideas about a consent agreement right now. I'm wanting to hear what some of the physicians would put forward.
Okay. Ms. Gallen?
Yeah, I'm listening to hear what some of the physicians are interested in doing right now.
Let me ask Dr. Campbell, and maybe we can put this together. Dr. Campbell, any suggestions? There are a couple violations as you, I was listening to your questioning that you kind of got into. Any ideas on drafting something?
Yes, well, ultimately, after we make a motion to adopt the findings of fact and conclusions of law listed in the investigative report, I believe that focusing on what it is that we set out to accomplish, which ultimately is protecting the public and making sure that mistakes do not happen again, focusing on the part of the violations that are listed in the investigative report, highlighting the conduct surrounding around referring the woman back to the person in the office who was running a space, and then having that person or that person then, did a procedure to take out the fluid buildup, and determining a level of probation. And, this case is very, very unique and specific in that when you think for a moment about, what possible CMEs you can take and whatnot, we don't have the issue with the doctor's abilities and experience of reference the procedure per se. And we don't have a complaint of, that somebody, as a result of his actions was hurt. And so trying to come up with some, CMEs and things that we can, put in there is going to, probably need to be more related, professionalism and ethics and whatnot, and just, coming up with things that we feel might be helpful along the way and reminders that all professionals need from time to time, if that makes sense. I think what I would like to do is I could make a motion that we do accept the findings of fact and conclusion of law listed in the investigative report. So I'll make that motion, and then once we've done that, then I guess we can move in.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Mr. Campbell, just so I understand the, so do we want to, you know, because we've done this a couple different times, different ways in the past. For some cases that are more complex, you've directed, you know, Gail and I to draft findings of fact and conclusions of law, which we then brought back to the board for to approve at a later meeting. It sounded like, and I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but it sounded like that everyone is sort of focused on one particular violation in this case, the violation of ARS 32-1501-31, subsection BB, delegating professional duties and responsibilities, and on, I won't quote the entire thing, but it's if that's the only violation that the board is concerned about, and you want to, you know, just fully develop the consent agreement today instead of having it brought back to the board next month, you could just make those findings of fact and conclusions of law specific today and say, you know, explain, you know, the statute that you're citing and the or whatever member makes the motion would just explain, you know, the statute that you're citing and the factual allegations in the record that you believe, you know, constitute that violation. And then we'll do that as one motion. And then the next part, we can decide, you know, what discipline to include in the consent agreement. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Is there a board with that, or did you want something brought back to the board later?
This is Dr. Rubin. I would second a motion if such a motion were made.
Well,
yeah, I have to say, Dr. Campbell, that's fine. I'm under the same guise as you are, and Dr. Rubin is. I mean, that would be 3215- I don't have the full thing in front of me, Ms. Larson. 3215-01BB is in boy boy. Right. So it'd be failure to provide proper personnel, procedural and post procedural. So can we make a motion, Dr. Campbell, you somewhat put it out there. Can we have you make the motion and then we can craft in some quick verbiage here to give Mr. Larson, Ms. Anthony, the necessary verbiage to put into this?
Sure. Well, again, this is Dr. Campbell. I'd like to make a motion that we adopt the findings of fact and investigative report specific to ARS 13-1501.31.BB regarding delegating professional responsibility to an unlicensed professional. I guess we can just leave it at that.
This is Dr. Rubin. I second that motion.
The only change I have is she may be licensed as a medical assistant, but she was unsupervised beyond her scope of duty.
Okay, I can make that amendment to my
original motion.
Please, yeah, to my original motion and statement.
And Dr. Rubin, you've seconded as...
Yes, Dr. Rubin, I second the amendment.
Okay. Then I guess we would do a roll from on this.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Ms. Larson, do we need to go anything further into this or allow you to make a rough draft and then the board to craft it from there?
It's up to you. We can, you know, Gail and I can draft findings of fact and conclusions of law and bring them back next month. Or you can, I mean, since it's a rather straightforward, you know, factual and legal issue here, you can, since you've made findings of fact and conclusions of law, you can, you know, decide now what you want the disciplinary portion of the consent agreement to include. You know, probation, I think someone had mentioned probation of some kind or whatever, but that will need to be, you know, borne out, either, you know, today, you know, or we can bring it back next month and you can discuss it.
Board members, what's your thought process? Do you want to let them do the draft and then craft it more next time? Do you want to craft it now?
I got a question. If we do not craft now, we will have to craft later, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'd prefer to just do it now, so we don't. It's more fresh in our minds, and I think we'll be it'll be better to do it now.
What do you guys think about 6 months of probation? Too long? Too short?
This is Dr. Rubin. I think 6 months is appropriate. I'm just having difficulty with the terms of the probation, and I was looking for help.
My biggest concern, I'm not so worried about the probation aspect, is that Dr. Ortiz has some type of backup system that he can establish within, he knows quite a bit of these procedures, within 30 to 60 days, probably who the nurse anesthetist is. We need her data in case she does come in and do a procedure. We need to know who she is, what her licensing number is as an RN. And MAs, whether they're certified through the board or whether they're certified through the state, who those are, and I would just like to see some type of office policy or procedure that post-procedural, if something goes down, this and that gets put into place. Sure, Dr. Rubin, you got that probably in your clinic. So that there is some type of system in place that if you had to have coverage, Dr. Ortiz, whether it's someone who knows liposuction or doesn't, you'd have another physician backing you up. So what I'm looking for is I just need a system in place that has to be in place within 30 to 60 days. It depends on the board members, but that the board knows that you have a system in place if something transpires.
How about Leslie?
You go ahead.
Okay, so yes, I understand that. What I would suggest, because I actually do, I have other colleagues that I consult with, I could provide the name of a plastic surgeon or another cosmetic surgeon that I could refer to. Again, the policy is strictly to send the patients to the emergency room, and that's what I would prefer to do. This was a case, like I said, I was sick and I had poor judgment. I should have just stayed sick and not tried to help the patient. I understand the board's stance on this and why, what the concern is, but this is something that happens routinely. This is something that happened under duress. But if need be, I can have another plastic surgeon certified that I can refer to them in such case where I'm incapacitated, debilitated, or can't attend to a patient for whatever reason. I'd be happy to provide someone to do that.
And additionally, I'd like to see that you have what your infrastructure of your office is, so that, whether they're naturopathic certified or board certified, your MA, who are they?
I don't have it.
Okay, but you're going to get them. Your RN.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I'm in the process of talking to someone now, and then we're going to go through the process of them getting certified.
Okay.
Before they come out.
The big thing is to make sure that they're, state licensed, so some that they have through the state of Arizona.
And we have all that documentation already. Yep.
Right. So those are the things I'm worried about, and I just want to see implemented. Yeah, Dr. Rubin, go ahead.
Okay.
I was just going to say, we're almost at 2 hours. He's a licensed physician. I think I'm just, he's continuing to talk. There was multiple lines of you know, issues that happened here. I think it's good enough just to say, show us what your office procedure is, and let's move on. I agree with you on that. I think it was well stated. I was just trying to maybe move this on because, anyhow.
That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
So we've got, we're going to have to do a roll call. I think we already did, Gail, didn't we, on the 3215-01DB.
Yeah, so you adopted findings of fact and conclusions of law for a consent agreement, which you were going to, which I understood you were going to offer, and then you were going to also include, you know, whatever we were discussing, the disciplinary terms that you wanted to include in the consent agreement.
So that's where we got hung up, Dr. Rubin. Do you want to move on since we've been 2 hours with this? Or do you want to
talk? I just think I love, this is Dr. Rubin, I love your formulation, and you know, my comment was more pointed towards Dr. Ortiz, that Dr. Sadalek has said what he needs, what he wants to see. We're going to vote on it. Let's see what you can do within, you know, and because this is our concern. And let's see his procedure and the backup and what his choices are. That's what I was meaning by that comment. And so we have one more motion to make, which is the terms of the probation.
Go ahead. Dr. Campbell put one out, and you go put one out. Let's see where we can get.
Well, I don't know that there was a formal motion made.
We're at 6 months, and so probation, and within 60 days, he's going to provide the board within 60 days. Information that we've already described related to his office that's already been spoke about. And then also, within the 6 months, okay, that he's going to need to complete, some CME regarding, medical ethics and responsibility. It needs to be pre-approved by the board, 10 hours of CME. And if there's nothing else, then those two things that we've addressed, the CME and what he needs to bring back to the board, and 6 months of probation, and we'll just vote that that's okay if that's okay, and we'll be done.
Is that a motion?
That is a motion.
This is Dr. Rubin. I second that motion.
And Gail, then go ahead and do roll call.
Okay. Dr. Sadalek?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Dr. Ortiz.
Thank you.
Go ahead and move on. We're going to be moving on to case number 22-22 to Dr. Michael Cronin. This is the initial interview.
This is Dr. Rubin.
Go ahead, Dr. Rubin.
This is Dr. Rubin. I formally recused just due to my relationship with Dr. Cronin.
Okay, noted. Dr. Rubin is recused. Any of the board members need to recuse? Okay. Gail, can you give us an overview?
Yeah. Dr. Sadalek, members of the board, on 5/30/2022, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a complaint from AM, who alleges she had an adverse effect from prolotherapy treatment provided by respondent on August 16th, 2021. AM signed a consent to treat form, which is available in the chart. While AM may have experienced a flare-up from the third procedure, there's no documented evidence because she refused to return to the office for an evaluation and treatment. According to respondent, had she come in, he likely would have used some pain medication if indicated, but he needed to see her to prescribe it correctly. Possibly some gabapentin, tramadol, or short-term hydrocodone. According to the records, respondent did in fact refund AM the money she paid.
Is the complainant on the phone?
Yes, the complainant is on the phone.
Dr. Cronin, are you on the phone?
I'm sorry, I took the mute off. I am on the phone.
Okay. So, Dr. Crone, can you give us just a real quick run?
Mr. Chair, sorry to interject. This is Justin. I mean, it's up to you. It's up to your discretion. But if you, I mean, just based on sort of the order of things, I think it might make more sense to have the complainant go first and then have the respondent.
Okay. Can you give us just a real quick rundown of what you want to, we've read your work, what you've sent in. Do you want to go over that with us, the board, really quickly? Just a summation, please.
Well, I have some of it in front of me. I went to Dr. Cronin for 3 sessions, and the last one was the one that left me with severe nerve damage and pain, reduced my quality of life. And when I did finally go back, when I was able to see Dr. Cronin, to have him examine me, he said, well, at least you're walking and talking. And my husband heard him say that as well. Showed no compassion whatsoever for my condition. And since then, ironically, my right knee has gotten worse where I can hardly walk. My jaw is misaligned, and my shoulder, left shoulder from the neck down into my arm and hand goes through periods of intense numbness. I'm already on gabapentin, for the record. I've been on gabapentin. And doctor knew all the issues that I had and still proceeded to put 30 needles in my neck with lots of issues, including bulging discs and cervical issues, stenosis and severe arthritis with nerve impingement. So my point is that he's already refunded me the money, but what he did was egregious. Because of the condition I'm in now.
What areas did he inject specifically on you? Do you remember?
He injected 30 needles in my neck alone of dextrose and B12 and lidocaine, which we found, and it's in your notes, can cause nerve damage and aggravate nerves. So I didn't know that. When I'd gone to him, I believed him and trusted him that he could help me.
You said your knee was bothering. Did he inject your knee?
Yes. He injected my knee on 2 occasions. I have it here. Yeah, he injected my knee in multiple places. He injected my back, which is still hurting on the left. I'm ending up going for help, and I end up in a horrible position now, worse than I ever was before I went to him.
And what was your expectation from him initially?
Yes, I went to him with arthritis in my shoulders, and that's the main thing. My leg, too, had a bump, a bone bruise. And he said that he could help that as well. So the two main things was my shoulder and my right knee.
Okay. And did he, you read his consent, et cetera. Did he guarantee you that you would be in less pain, more pain?
Verbally. Verbally he said that it would tighten up my shoulders. And it didn't matter that I had nerve issues to begin with. That's why I was on gabapentin. And he said that it would help me. Since then, I go to a naturopath here in Sedona, and she said she would have never done neck needles without a guided ultrasound.
Okay.
So he didn't use anything to guide the needles, and apparently he must have hit a nerve in my left side of my neck, and that's what happened. I've been to every kind of doctor imaginable, and nobody can really help.
Okay, so did you see a neurologist, anybody with an MRI of your neck, MRA, anything like that?
I got an MRI of my neck, yes. And I went to also a neck surgeon as well as a neurologist. So I have a, recent, I don't know when it, it's not in front of me, but it was after, yeah, it was after that, I believe. Uh-huh. And the neurologist was after that too. That was August 16th of 2021.
Okay.
And I saw Dr. Crum.
Let me ask really quick, then, board members, do you have any questions for her?
BK, I was curious your experience after the first and second treatment, how you felt, improvements that you had seen. I just would be curious about your experience with the first two appointments.
Well, what I remember is the first appointment, I felt like maybe it was helping and I wanted to go on and trust the process. I didn't feel any bad reactions. After the second one, it was quasi, like I was okay, but I was noticing different things, like more numbness in my fingertips, a little bit more, but nothing like the way it was after August. I went back for the third one. Yeah.
Right, and the third time I'm sorry, I don't know exactly, you added one more joint area to be injected on the third treatment, or, I believe?
I think, yeah. I had a doctor said that, by the way, I wasn't told it was going to be that many needles, or I wouldn't have consented, and Jeff was the one that counted, my husband was the one that counted how many went in. So on the last treatment, it was, yes, he did 1, 2, 3, 4. He did $900 worth. And what I've read on it is you're not supposed to inject that many. There are toxic effects of prolotherapy. We since found out. We didn't know. I didn't know.
Well, I mean, the concern would be, obviously, is there too much lidocaine being administered? And I have some questions for Dr. Cronin in a minute, but clearly based on his statement and the levels of lidocaine injected, there's clearly not an increase or not a toxic level of lidocaine that was injected for you. Were you immediately after procedure one or procedure two, were you dizzy, lightheaded, in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, I'm sure I was. I don't remember exactly, but I'm sure I was, because that's a lot of, the first and second was a lot for me, because I'm 103 pounds. Okay, I'm not a regular sized person. I'm only 5'2".
I understand your weight. I'm just curious if you were actually dizzy. I'm not saying you've done anything wrong. I'm just saying you go back for the second and third treatments. I'm trying to understand, had you had concerns, did you raise your concerns about the number of shots that were given to you after the first or second treatment?
Oh, because I trusted Dr. Cronin, and he was the expert, and he said he could help me, and I wanted to believe him.
Understood.
So I thought did you feel
like the number of treatments or the number of injections that were done with the first couple treatments were excessive, in your opinion?
I felt like I didn't feel like it was too much at that time. Yeah.
Gotcha. Because, I mean, certainly you can go online and find all kinds of information supporting your perspective or not. Certainly based on, I do prolotherapy as well, it's more so about, can the patient tolerate it, and is there a lidocaine or a flupirtine or procaine maximum that you're going over? And, I saw somewhere where you quoted saying, maximum 4 to 15 shots in an appointment. And everybody's got their perspective, and I would say that is somebody whose perspective, I'm not going to say it's wrong, but it's not what standard prolotherapy appointments would be, is treating multiple joint areas and only doing somewhere between 5 and 15 injections. So, not saying that you've commented anything wrong, I just want you to understand that some of the statements you've made concerning Dr. Cronin's care are one perspective in a spectrum of reality of what prolotherapy doctors do. That's all I'm asking. It's just, I was curious about your first and second treatment.
Right. All I want to say is that he didn't, it didn't take into account that that was might be a little bit too much for me, given all the issues that I told him and he had the record. At one point, he lost my record and didn't want to give them back, and then I only got back part of them, my MRIs, my x-rays. So I don't know what happened, but I'm just saying that.
You had this significant reaction to treatment number three, was there a reason you did not follow up with Dr. Cronin?
Oh, no. I couldn't go anywhere. Like, I live in my house since then.
So it was the severity of symptoms that you were experiencing that prevented you from following up. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's fine.
So I did go back, though, not right away, because I couldn't.
Understood.
I did go back, and that's when he said, oh, at least you're walking and talking. Nice guy.
Gotcha. Understood. That's all my questions right now, Dr. Satterwick.
Thank you. Ms. Tippett?
I don't have any questions.
Ms. Galler?
I don't have any questions at this time.
And Dr. Campbell?
Nothing at this moment.
Dr. Spatz?
Yes, hi. Thank you for being on the boat, and thank you for your testimony. I just have a few questions I just want to ask you. So after this, I just want to follow up on what Dr. Poppy was asking you. So after the second treatment, did you mention to Dr. Cronin some of the side effects that you experienced at all? I'm just curious, what was the compensation and so forth?
Well, like I said, I didn't remember if I apparently must have felt a little dizzy. That's all I can remember. I don't remember having serious issues. I felt like maybe there was, you know, a little bit more numbness. I thought maybe that was the lidocaine, where, until it wore off, and then apparently it wore off. But the last time, it never wore off.
Okay. So between the first and the second, and the second and third treatment, how long did you have to wait till you come back to Dr. Cronin for the follow-up treatment?
Right. I went initially. Kind of business here. I went initially in. I have a July 12th. I have July 19th. It seems pretty close, but that's what he said, so I did it. And then August 16th, the last one. So 3 visits in total, sir.
Okay. All right. All right. Then the last treatment that you get on August, did you mention to Dr. Cronin of your concern? I just want to get more detail.
I know what it was. My memory is not that great either. On the second treatment, I raised concern. On the second treatment, and he said, "What are you trying to?" He yelled at me, and he said, "Are you trying to micromanage my treatment?" And I said, "No, but it's my body, and I am very fragile." That's what you just prompted me to remember. Thank you. So I did express concerns. Yes, I did.
Okay. And what did Dr. Cronin do when you were going to when you mentioned that to him?
That's what I said. He yelled at me. He said, "Are you trying to micromanage my treatment?" He was angry. And my husband was like, "Noticed it too." We both noticed it. We were in the room for all three. He was in the room with me for all three appointments.
Okay. Now, how did you get to know Dr. Cronin Clinic? Did someone refer you, or did you search their cell, or how did that happen?
There was a lady that referred, but I was searching on my own, and I thought that he had a lot of good experience and that he knew what he was doing.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much, yeah. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. AM, what was your thought process today? Apparently, he did, as you stated, he did refund you the money for the treatment. What were you expecting to gain today by coming to the board?
Well, I just felt like I needed to voice my feelings and my truth and what happened to me.
Okay.
I didn't want money from him. I didn't ask for any money from him. I just felt like, you know, I needed to be true to who I am and speak my truth.
And how was it concluded with Dr. Cronin? He said, sorry, it didn't work. Here's your money back. Was that the final
conclusion? No, he didn't give me my money back for a long time. Then I searched on the board, your board, and naturopathic board, and he, I don't know, right after that, all of a sudden, I got a call back from his office. After I searched on the board and found him on there, I didn't do anything. I just searched. And then I got a call from his office, from his manager, who, you know, said that, you know, he was going to refund me the money. And that was how it was left.
Okay. So today, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but today your goal was to kind of just make the board aware of what you had gone through.
Yeah, if he's still practicing, which I don't know if he is.
Okay, well, we'll hear from him, but when we do hear from him, we're only going to hear from him. So
oh,
I think he's on the line. Dr. Cronin, can you... give comment.
Sure. I guess I'll just present as kind of similar to my written response, which was a patient came in on the first visit, specifically scheduled for PRP. She had 5 chief complaints that were identified. The right knee, the right shoulder, the left shoulder, the neck, cervical stenosis, and the fifth was jaw, face, trigeminal nerve. The evaluated this was a pretty personal body. With her 45 positive response on current symptoms, as well as notes talking about EMJ problems, nerve damage. I said there's no way I'm doing PRP on you on the first visit. And that what we would be using would be a 15% dextrose solution. I'm going to be applying them with my nuptial needles, which are thin needles. So that means for the most part, I'm using as well as usually a 30-gauge 1-inch, as well as a 25-gauge intra-articular. I'm telling the board that just so you understand that I mostly use 27-gauge, especially in a cervical and thoracic area on a senior person. She responded, she didn't want one. Including her cervical cassette as well as her thoracic cassette, because when I examined her, nerve pain itself, you can measure weakness, so you can measure muscle weakness, you can measure sensation, and you can measure, you know, but from the standpoint of pain, where her trigger points were diverse. She had tenderness at C2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, T1, and her 3 upper thoracic, 1, 2, and 3. My instructions and how I just put them there is this is about not treating a specific pathology as much as for you. In very severe cervical x-rays, you know you have nerve damage, which is a long issue, November 3rd asset with these 27 gauge needles. I said I'd like to see you in a week. We'll repeat the prolo therapy at a little stronger dosage. So she came back in. That second visit, we treated her neck and upper thoracic, her knee. And instead of treating her shoulder, we treated her right left big gluteus. So the first treatment, I used 59 milliliters of prolo therapy solution at 15% concentration of glucose. Second visit, I used 91 milliliters of prolo therapy at a 20% concentration. So going a little bit stronger, seeing how she tolerated it. And then I said, let's go a month, let you integrate that treatment, come back in a month, and we'll try PRP. If we do okay with the second visit of 20%, then we can go to the PRP, which is exactly what we did. When she came back in, she requested not I treat three joints, but four joints. So her neck and upper thoracic, her right shoulder, her left shoulder, and her left knee. And so then, I would say in relationship, I used 91 milliliters. I used the same amount of proliferate on the third visit as I did on the second. And so I used the same amount of lidocaine. We, for her body weight, not for a generic body weight, for a 100-pound woman, we were at half of any kind of toxic dose on the lidocaine. So it was not that. So then we went through this post-treatment procedure where I said, you know, you can come back in a month. And then that's where we got through letters of concern, offer her a phone call of concern at the end of that week. I called her back on an off day on Friday, checked in how she was doing. She was in discomfort. I said, you know, come in, let me evaluate you. And at that point, we really didn't see her again, except we did after she wrote her November letter about how upset she was with the treatment. We again reached out to her and said, you know, please come in, let me evaluate you, and I'll give you my destination. And she came in, and, you know, they were, I checked her range of motion, I checked her, she was really, there was no noticeable decrease in range of motion. There was no overt acute pain situation. But at this point, we were August, September, October, November. You know, she had basically, from my perspective, after she had the third treatment with the aggravation, she discontinued care with me. And that's where she, you know, perceived other expertise. And I was kind of, you know, not able to manage her flare. On the November letter, as a part when she responded that she was unhappy with the care, as a woman, we said, as is, my policy, I'm see if you're not happy with it. And that was, she really hadn't asked for her money back. And I asked her, you know, what she wanted, and then that's when she said that she would like everything back. So we cut her a check. So I tried to take good care of this patient. We suggested that she read Prolo, which talks about, but which they did get, and they did report that they read. We suggested players, and I honestly tried to do the best I could for this woman. On this first visit, I saw she was had a lot of conditions, she had prior nerve damage, but I did feel like I could help her. And so I took her on, even though I know when a patient or husband come in and that good, you know, take them out like crazy, you know, that is potentially something that could help. And I would apologize to the patient, you know, that she aggravated, but I do believe, you know, that I gave her my best care possible.
Board members, any questions? Dr. Papil, Dr. Spatz, Dr.
I have a. This is Karen Tibbetts. I just have a couple questions.
Sure.
Doctor, did she in general have a
have greater risk than your typical patient? Or have you seen patients with her level of symptoms?
I would say that many of my patients are complex patients. And so she was not more complex. You know, she was mobile in, mobile out. Her range of motion was not severely limited. It was limited, but not to an unusual extent. And the biggest things were her concerns, you know, anxiety, depression, anger, irritability, nerve damage, TMJ. You know, she had a very significant health history, as I don't need to, you know, read it all here.
And I just wanted to confirm that you communicated that no injection procedures can be completely risk-free. I just wanted to have you confirm that.
Yes.
That you communicated to her. Okay.
Both through the signature disclosure, by her reading the book and understanding, it goes into very big detail. And then just, you know, they had so much, you know, it was interesting because they had a balance of being super vigilant, okay, where, you know, we want to, and they expressed that. But at the same time, the first time, they didn't want one joint done, they wanted three. The second time, she wanted three kind of different joints done. The third time, she wanted four joints done. So I tried to do them in as appropriate a dose as possible. When we are doing injection therapy, it is possible to touch a nerve. Get a book, I would refer to as kind of a zinger. These usually have a lifespan. Again, you're not lacerating the nerve with these 27 gauge needles. You know, you may, you know, create some inflammation, some stinging, and anywhere from about 3 to 8 weeks as the patient.
Okay. And I just have one more question. So you mentioned that treatment number 2 and treatment number 3 both had the same amount of lidocaine. Was there any other difference besides the number of joints?
The platelets. We use platelets. So the first treatment is a hypertonic concentration of glucose or dextrose. And then the third visit was what she had requested on the first, which is platelet-rich plasma. And that procedure was a lot of patients' blood and centrifuges. We take out the red blood cells and we add the same amount of lidocaine for the prolo therapy with the dextrose. So the difference was that instead of injecting glucose with basically a 1% propane lidocaine solution, we were injecting our own blood with a 1% propane lidocaine solution.
Thank you.
Same volume.
I don't have any more questions. Thank you.
Ms. Gallen, any questions for Dr. Cronin?
No, not at this.
Dr. Campbell.
Yes, Dr. Cronin, I'm not sure if you heard the part of the testimony by the patient when she had spoke with another physician about the procedure. The physician indicated that if they were to be doing injections in the neck, they would have never done it without having the assistance of ultrasound. Can you speak about that? Is that something that you did use?
Sure.
And thank you.
Sure. So the I have an ultrasound machine and I use it for certain joints. When I have a 103-year-old lady, you are so able to correctly palpate the facet and the ligaments that introducing one of the ultrasounds, I believe, makes it more difficult, slightly more risky, and is really not necessary unless it's a very good person. So what we're aiming at is basically something the size of a knuckle on your hands, depending on the and they have bigger facets. So I do not use ultrasound in the cervical facet because my left thumb is right next to where I want to push, where I want to inject. I feel the joint capsule,
and I'm really only going in like half an inch from any of these, and maybe as much as 3/4 of an inch or an inch for the thoracic or intra-articular. So does that answer your question?
Hey, it does. Okay. And actually, my other two questions were already answered by other board members' questions. And so, Mr. Chairman, that's all that I had. Thank you.
Dr. Spatz, any more questions for Dr. Cronin?
I don't have any questions at the moment. Thank you.
And I'll finish up with you, Dr. Papio. Any questions for Dr. Cronin anymore?
Yeah, I got a couple. And Dr. Cronin, I appreciate the commentary and info you provided the board after the fact. Looking at your chart notes, I've not seen any information about volume of solution injected, particularly what you're injecting other than you just say like cervical or shoulder. Am I missing that in your notes, or is that information that defines all that?
There's one page in there that is a table. It is a
I
chart.
See that.
And then within that, if you look on the first column, would be the first visit to the left, and there would be an indicator of 15%, and right next to the 15% would be how many milliliters I injected right next to it at that level. So when she says 333, that is actually what I do. So basically, I'm touching C23, C34, C45, oftentimes with one injection. Boom, 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 upper, middle, lower, theory, 1, 2, 3,
okay.
And then move to the upper thoracic. And so I have the volume on that chart, both for the 15% in the first visit, the 20% indicated on the second visit, and then PRP on the third visit.
I gotcha. Okay. So essentially, you're just talking about a dextrose concentration. There's no mention of lidocaine in the chart notes.
We have, you know, we do not mix that for every patient. It's pre-mixed by our naturopathic medical assistant, the same way we've been doing it for approximately, you know, 15 years. And that is 1% lidocaine.
And then as far as, you know, what you're actually injecting, I guess, do you feel like your chart notes support, you know, the comprehensiveness of your care and the treatments that you're providing?
Well, I mean, I do. I guess, you know, that's up to you to decide if they're, you know, comprehensive enough. This was, you know, these are, initial visit is 1 hour, return visit is a half hour. And so we're, you know, documenting a quite complex case, you know, during that time, as well as, you know, we try to provide, you know, a cost-effective treatment modality, and there is an efficiency within the visit.
Okay. I'm just looking at, like, your chart note for the 19th says Prolo number 2 for cervical, right shoulder, right knee. I'm just raising the point that nobody else would be able to pick that up and know exactly what you injected for that patient and what ligaments particularly you're shooting for. You know, I understand because I do prolotherapy, but I'm just raising that as a concern with the chart notes, and not necessarily having assessment that I see typically. Can you comment on the patient's statement about number of injections, what you would normally provide, how many injections per session you would say would be reasonable to provide a patient?
So when doing, say, you know, the comment is on, had been on, you know, 30 injections in the cervical and upper thoracic. And so what I'm doing on the upper cervical is I'm injecting, and then I'm going 1, 2, 3. So I'm getting the C23, C34, C35, and then I do my second injection midline, and I'm getting 5, 6, 7, So there are 30 injection points, but the number of skin piercings is not that high, but it does cover the from C23 down to T34.
And so that's 15 each side, which, you know, is not unusual.
I was going to say, in your experience with practitioners you've talked with, trained over the years, the number of injections you've provided is fairly in line with what the standard of care is.
Yes. We are emphasizing regenerative injection therapy that treats, sometimes you're treating a specific lesion, a tent, a bite, you know, calcified tendonitis. But so often with a complex patient, you're really trying to create regional stability. There's not one place that is broken, irritated, or strained. So you're trying to stabilize the structure. And so the perspective on that as a prolotherapy, as represented by, you know, many of the prolotherapists, including Dr. Hauser, is regional, is effective at strengthening people's structure. So I would say that what I administered to the patient was reasonable.
I don't have any additional questions at this time, Dr. Sadler.
Any of the board members have questions for Dr. Cronin? Okay, then let's go ahead and...
I just want to say there was no PRP done to me. No blood was drawn at any time from me.
This is Dr. Maria. Dr. Cronin, your chart notes don't actually suggest anything related to PRP for treatment number 3. So, do you know if you did PRP? It doesn't sound like it.
Honestly, I'm in a parking lot. We're on vacation, and it may have been that third treatment was not PRP. If that's what my records indicate and the patients indicate, I apologize for my error. I'm in a
Yeah, it wasn't the first
time. So we did three prolotherapy.
Yes.
I'm sorry to, you know, correct.
All right. So, board members, anyone want to make a motion?
I find it, you know, very unfortunate. TK has ongoing issues. I feel like the standard of care for treatment, the treatments provided were appropriate. I personally don't feel that guidance is necessary for the vast majority of joints. So in my opinion, the only concern I have is the chart notes, but as far as any sort of additional concerns in this case, I don't really have any, so I would recommend dismissal.
I would like to second that. Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
This is Karen Tibbetts. I'd like to second that motion.
And Dionne, you want to make a roll call?
Yes. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Dr. Cronin. All right, let's go
ahead. Thank you.
We move on. I'm going to make a motion for a 5-minute recess. It's 229, we'll meet back at 2:35.